Welcome to another episode of Spanish History 101, brought to you by Brian Spain Domain. We are now finally in the 20th century. Thank God it's taken us 40 episodes to get there. But there you have it, the turn of the century, the turn of the last century at least. And with its arrival, we will see some pretty big changes occurring in Spain. This is the Spain during the reign of Alfonso XIII, which will last until 1931. But today we are only going to go all the way up until 1923 because there is a lot to talk about and there is a reason for cutting it off at that point, which we will talk about in a few minutes. Let's get started with the situation. Spain has just lost its last big territories overseas, Cuba, the Philippines, and Puerto Rico, to the United States in the Spanish-American War. That was in 1898. In Spain, it's known as the Disaster of 98. And that succinctly describes the outcome of this brief three-month conflict. Spain lost pretty much everything. They were routed in the two naval battles they engaged in, and the army fared little better. Theodore Roosevelt famously called it a splendid little war, and from an American military standpoint, it pretty much was. It was nearly the perfect war. Short, sweet, few casualties, and a handsome trophy to take home. This defeat took Spain spinning into a national crisis of identity and sparked a major philosophical and artistic movement known as the Generation of 98. A number of great minds in Spain would come from this period, such as Unamuno, Pío Baroja, Azorín, the Machado brothers, and more, many more. The Spain of the turn of the century trailed behind many other developed nations. These were tough times. The average life expectancy was about 34 years. Illiteracy was at 60%. Child mortality was at nearly 50% before the age of 5. And while it is true that Spain is going through its industrial revolution and industry is growing, it is generally concentrated in the Basque Country and Catalonia. The majority of the population, about 70%, lives in the countryside, in the villages and small towns. Poverty is extensive. Many living in rural settings will now start to search for better opportunities and flee to the cities or abroad. This will begin a long period of migrating to other places in search of a better life. So that's where we are. Now, in 1902, Alfonso XIII takes over from his mom, Maria Cristina, as King of Spain. He is 16 years old and now considered old enough to take over. 2 years later, he marries an English woman, Victoria Eugenia of Battenberg, one of Queen Victoria's granddaughters. Their marriage would last the rest of their lives, but it couldn't have gotten off to a worse start when, on the day of the wedding, an anarchist named Mateo Moral dropped a bomb next to the newlyweds' carriage as it approached the royal palace. A bizarre stroke of good luck saved their lives, but the attack did kill at least 24 bystanders, possibly more. Anyway, Spain during the time of Alfonso's active reign continued with the custom of turnism, which is where you had two major parties, the Liberal Party and the Conservative Party, and they would take turns running the government. As we mentioned in previous podcasts, with this system, you had democratic elections, but they were basically a farce. Essentially, they were legally rigged. This had brought stability to the country somewhat, but not as much as it used to. Internal struggles in both parties weakened their position, and it weakened the system as a whole. Social unrest was starting to get out of hand. Workers' movements had been slow to start, but now they are taking over in Spain, the way they were in many parts of the world. Anarchism became especially popular here, which is sort of the last thing this country needed, given its complex profile, with the different social classes, the highly agricultural economy, the caciquism, which is that sort of local boss-controlled system, and then you had nationalism from the different regions, especially in the Basque Country and Catalonia, where there were increased demands for more self-rule. And these were also the regions that were probably the richest parts of Spain. So that was another factor that was leading to friction between the central government and the different regions. So we're talking about a total mess. One of the big prime ministers at this time was a man named Antonio Maura. He was known as a regenerationist. This was a movement that was trying to turn Spain's decline around and modernize the country. Maura tried to get rid of that caciquism system. He wanted to reform democracy, and he also wanted to bring the middle class into a more active role in society. So they were working on that, but then Spain did something pretty stupid, in part because it had little choice, and in part because it probably hoped to recover some national pride after the disaster of 98, when they lost their overseas colonies. That is, Spain got involved in Northern Africa, namely Morocco. Now, Spain already had two territories there. One is Ceuta and the other is Melilla. They're small autonomous cities that belong to Spain. Now, anyway, getting back to our story here, in 1906, there was a conference that was held in Algeciras, which is in the south of Spain. And there were many European powers there, like Great Britain, France, Germany, and Spain, obviously. And there was an attempt to sort of figure out what to do about Morocco, which had mostly been under French influence. And in the end, Spain was sort of obligated to control the north of Morocco, a region called Rif, RIF, and it became a protectorate of Spain. This territory was mountainous, mountainous land inhabited by tribes and clans of fierce fighters who lived in rugged terrain and who were in no way prepared to accept being occupied by a foreign presence. So Spain was taking on a very complicated task, and the result would be a long, bloody, messy, and mostly unsuccessful string of wars and conflicts that really did little to benefit Spain, with the exception of maybe some mines. But that isn't saying much. On top of that, in order to control these new areas that were becoming more problematic, the government saw the need to call on the reserves to join the armed forces, and that triggered massive resistance in certain parts of Spain. For example, in 1909 in Barcelona, many who were drafted were from the working classes, while the rich could basically pay to find substitutes for them. That's the way things were done back then. The result was a huge uprising instigated by the wives of many of these men because they were terrified because their husbands were the breadwinners for their homes, and if they left to fight a war, there'd be no one to bring in money. Workers' movements backed the women and declared a general strike, and chaos reigned. For reasons that are not entirely clear, many of these groups, especially the anarchists, turned their anger out on the church more than anything, and they began to sack 50 churches and convents throughout the city. There's a photograph where you could just see these huge plumes of smoke all over the city, sort of billowing out, and most of them are churches and convents and religious schools. This conflict, this uprising became known as the Tragic Week of Barcelona, and in the end, over 100 citizens, residents, and uprisers were killed, a few of the soldiers too, and the episode ended the government of Antonio Maura, and it brought in a new prime minister named José Canalejas. He took over, he promoted a number of important reforms, but his hopes were cut short when he was assassinated himself in the streets of Madrid in 1912. So you have this time where there are attempts to improve the situation in Spain, but there's a lot of instability. Now, the next big event that happened in Europe would actually be beneficial. Spain did not get involved in World War I militarily, and this proved to be very positive for the country for economic reasons. Almost all the sectors and industries boomed as they provided services and supplies to both sides. This can often happen when a country doesn't get involved in a war. And this was also a time when Alfonso XIII set up basically on his own a kind of non-profit organization, an NGO of sorts, designed to help families to find information or news about missing loved ones in the war. The office assisted families from both sides, and Alfonso was highly praised for his efforts. He even wrote some of the letters to these families personally. Overall, more than 200,000 families or requests were handled, and many were successfully solved. After the war, excess exports led to scarcity in the country and also inflation. The prices rose in some cases by 40% and renewed hardship for many, but especially the most disadvantaged, and that led to greater discontent among the left-wing parties and the workers. In addition, Spain's involvement in the Rif region of Morocco that I was telling you about before took a tragic hit in the Battle of Annual, Annual, more than a battle, it was a campaign that went terribly wrong, and it resulted in a horrific and humiliating defeat for what should have been a superior military force. The Rifian leader, Abdel Krim, led a well-orchestrated assault on the retreating Spanish troops. These were troops that had gone inland and realized it was not a good idea, so they tried to retreat to the coast. And after 10 days of fighting, over 13,000 Spanish and African troops, by African troops, basically Moroccans who were supporting the Spanish army against approximately 800 Rifians being killed. So this was a devastating loss for Spain and for Spain's reputation. One notable thing I want to mention about the African campaigns is that Spanish soldiers like Francisco Franco would get a lot of their military and battle experience there. Franco actually received a lot of praise for his bravery and his good relationship with his men. This would become important down the road when we get to the Spanish Civil War. Spain's involvement in the Rif region of Morocco obviously would increase instability in Spanish politics, which were already going through a delicate period. Administrations were changing constantly. You had other leaders like Eduardo Dato. Eduardo Dato was also assassinated, so the situation was pretty shaky. Now, if you've been following this series on the history of Spain up until now, you should be able to know or guess what was going to happen next when the country begins to fall into disarray. You got it. A coup d'etat, or a semi-coup in this case, being instigated by an iron-fisted member of the military who was there to take over and organize things the way he thinks it should be done. In this case, the individual was a man named Miguel Primo de Rivera, a general who was born in Jerez de la Frontera in Cádiz in the south of Spain. It was in September of 1923, and he announced a pronunciamiento, which I was telling you was a sort of a classic Spanish coup d'etat. It started in Barcelona, of all places. It wasn't backed by a lot of others, a lot of people at first, but at the same time, there was not a lot of opposition there either. Even Alfonso XIII did basically nothing to stop him, and that made many believe that the king was secretly in favor of it. The king would pay a price for this down the road as opposition to the monarchy increased at the end of the decade. Officially, the Bourbon Restoration period that started all the way back in the 19th century had not ended yet, but the end is getting near. And democratic Spain, although it was never quite as democratic as it should have been, had given way to an authoritarian system. So that would have a profound effect on Spanish politics and Spanish history in the next 15 years. Now, besides this immense political instability and the colonial warfare woes, this was also a strong period of Spanish ingenuity in the sciences and technology. Gregorio Marañón, for example, would win a Nobel Prize in medicine and would become known as the father of neuroscience. Juan de la Cierva would invent the autogyro, and his rotary system would form the basis of the modern helicopter. And then you have Leonardo Torres Quevedo, my big hero here, who would come up with the foundations of wireless technology, no less. Think about how much of our world is controlled by wireless technology. Well, he was basically the first, along with Tesla, to get this whole system working. He also worked on the foundations of modern computer science and possibly created the first computer game, a chess game. So there was plenty to talk about and be proud of in these departments. But anyway, we will stop there, and that will be all for this episode of Spanish History 101. We hope you've enjoyed it. Please leave us any questions or comments because we love the feedback. You can subscribe to our podcast on Spotify, Apple, Amazon, and Castos. You can also check us out on our YouTube channel and subscribe. Or if you wish to support Brian's Spain Domain, we'd greatly appreciate it. We work very hard to provide you with the best information about Spain, Spanish history, and Spanish culture. You can do so by clicking on our PayPal donate button, or if you want to have access to absolutely all of our podcasts and support us regularly, you can check us out on Patreon at the link provided below. Stay well, stay safe, and hasta pronto.